Is humanity's future in space? If you listen to Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, or some of the other billionaire space enthusiasts out there, you'd think so. These entrepreneurs, along with fellow true believers in government and the private sector, have a vision for colonies on Mars, civilians in near-Earth orbit, and a human species that has made a definitive step away from its home planet. But Mary Jane Rubenstein points out that this vision has disturbing parallels with the religious, colonialist ideology of manifest destiny, and that the dreams of colonizing space may mask other, more cynical goals. Mary Jane teaches religion and science studies at Wesleyan University, and she joins us today to share five big ideas from her new book, Astrotopia, The Dangerous Religion of the Corporate Space Race.
Hi, I'm Mary Jane Rubenstein. I teach at Wesleyan University, and I write about unexpected collisions of science and religion. This is my book bite. Insight number one. The billionaires who want to colonize outer space sound like old-fashioned prophets. The end is near. The Earth is not our home. We're in this world, but not of it. And if we cling too tightly to our terrestrial prison, we'll surely die. But if we heed the word of the prophet, we'll follow him out of this veil of tears and into a new land, a better land, where we can finally be free and our generations will endure forever. We're used to hearing this kind of story, coming disaster, otherworldly salvation from, you know, the Bible, or the sermons of 17th century Puritans, or the annals of Mormon history, or that guy on the street with a long beard and a sign on a stick telling us to repent. We know it all too well from the charismatic religious movements that spring up from time to time, build a utopia in some far-off corner of the world, and end in unbearable violence. Yet here it is, in the mouths of billionaires, a barely disguised doomsday prophecy instructing us to leave the Earth. The best known of these techno-prophets are Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Both of them are telling us the end is coming and the future is elsewhere, but with different details. For Musk, something is going to wipe out all of humanity, whether it be an asteroid, nuclear war, AI robots gone wild. So unless we want people to go the way of the dinosaurs, we're going to have to find a backup planet, and the best candidate is Mars. For Bezos, the problem is more gradual. We're using too much energy. There simply isn't enough power to keep running our first-rate hospitals, chilling our high-end microbrews, and charging our endless devices. So unless we want to stop living this lavishly, we're going to have to live elsewhere. And the best candidate is, drumroll, rotating space pods in near-Earth orbit. Given what we know about religious utopias, something ought to be telling us not to trust these kinds of promises. And yet the last 10 years have seen more and more of the U.S. space sector given over to private corporations, whose obligation is to maximize profit for shareholders, and yet who tell us they are leading us to an otherworldly land of salvation and freedom. Insight number two. Religion tends to show up where it's least expected, like in space. A former student of mine wrote a whole senior thesis based on the astonishment she felt when she visited a space museum, popped in an old recording of the Apollo 8 mission, and heard astronauts Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders reading the first chapter of Genesis as they orbited the moon. Genesis, she thought. All that science, all that military training, all those wires and communications devices and rocket fuel and precise gravitational calculations, and at the self-proclaimed height of human attainment, these astronauts are reading Genesis. The story of the selection of Genesis is multi-layered and fun, and you can read all about it in Chapter 4. But the farther you get into the history and present of space exploration, the more you find religion all over the place. Like in Wernher von Braun, the former Nazi rocket scientist who designed the Apollo prototype and set the broad stages the U.S. is still following as it aims for a permanent presence in space. As he undertook denazification on American soil, von Braun became a born-again Christian and began to insist it was God's will that America conquer the spaceways for Christ. More recently, in 2019, Vice President Mike Pence revealed that the vision hadn't changed when he assured the National Space Council that wherever the U.S. sends its astronauts, quote, there God's hand will guide us, and his right hand will hold us fast, unquote. The text comes from Psalm 139. And then 1 year later, Donald Trump sealed the divine providence deal by calling outer space America's manifest destiny. Sure, you might say, but those are politicians. The scientists aren't using this sort of religious rhetoric. But if that's the case, then why do they keep naming their missions and machines after gods? One might think here of Mercury, Apollo, Orion, Osiris, and the newly launched Artemis, whose intention is to establish a permanent presence and a vibrant new economy on the moon. Okay, so what am I saying? That politicians and scientists are actually religious in spite of themselves? Probably not. Who knows? I'm not even sure it matters. What I'm saying is that just as the billionaire spacemen cloud their fiscal motivations with ideological fog machines, so do the politicians and scientists at the other corners of the space program. Ask the American public if they think it's a good idea to mine the moon within an inch of its life and turn it into a cosmic gas station. This is a direct quotation from a space mining CEO competing for government contracts. And you might get some pushback. Ask the American public if it supports the Artemis mission. And we're so entranced by middle school memories of the flowing hair and the awesome bow and arrow and some moonlit companion stag and girl power that we couldn't possibly say no. Insight number three, things are bad out there. Before the launch of the Russian satellite Sputnik in 1957, Earth had precisely one satellite, the moon. Now it's got the remnants of everything that's ever been up there, including operative satellites, defunct satellites, pieces of shrapnel, nuts, bolts, sprocket kits, fumbled cameras and cell phones, and the International Space Station. To make matters worse, Elon Musk launches 60 new satellites into orbit every 2 weeks. 60 of them. Every 2 weeks. By 2027, he aims to send, get this, 42,000 satellites into low Earth orbit so he can build the fastest Wi-Fi network ever. And our poor astronomers are going out of their minds. With all the light bouncing off these thousands of satellites, they say, they can barely see the stars. Meanwhile, indigenous communities in Australia are distraught over the pollution of the skies, which are sacred to them, which ought to be sacred to all of us. How is Musk allowed to launch this many satellites into orbit? Because the FAA lets him do it. How is the FAA authorized to make decisions that affect not just the US, but the entire planet? Well, it's not. But who's going to stop it? There are international agreements. One big one in particular called the Outer Space Treaty that hypothetically ensures that we all behave ourselves in space. The problem is, this treaty is outdated, loophole-y, and totally unenforceable. For example, even though the Outer Space Treaty forbids any nation from claiming part or the whole of a celestial body, say the moon, the US has decided it doesn't forbid claiming the stuff in a celestial body, like water and helium-3 on the moon, or rare earth and precious metals in an asteroid. And of course, if you're NASA, and you've commissioned a company like Solar System Resources to sink mines on the moon, NASA has done this, you're not going to let anyone else near that mine. So you'll have security. You'll have fences and armed troops. You'll have guardians from the US Space Force. So you've effectively claimed that part of the celestial body. For this reason, numerous nations are complaining that the U.S. is in total violation of the Outer Space Treaty. In response, the U.S. says, no, we're not. And that's more or less the end of it. Again, who's going to stop them? Meanwhile, China, Russia, and the U.S. have now got branches of the military dedicated to waging extraterrestrial war. Richard Branson is selling $200,000 tourist tickets on his notoriously unreliable space plane, and some astronautic startup says it's going to build a Ferris wheel-shaped orbital space hotel and name it after Wernher von Braun. And in the midst of all of it, Jeff Bezos takes his hero William Shatner up through the atmosphere, only to watch him burst into tears when he comes back, fumbling for the right words to say after all those years he spent longing for outer space, pretending he was its captain and its king, when he suddenly realized our only possible home is Earth. That's death, stammers an aging James T. Kirk, baffled and horrified as he points toward the emptiness out there. And this, he says, pointing toward our only Earth, this is life. Insight number four, space isn't going to solve our problems. Whatever our biggest concern might be, living on Mars with Elon or in an extraterrestrial shopping mall with Jeff isn't going to solve it. An asteroid might just as well hit Mars as Earth. Nuclear war might break out in space colonies as easily as it might break out down here. And bounding around in one-third Martian gravity or using infinite energy in a space pod won't be nearly so exciting when the oxygen runs out. What I'm trying to say is that we're not going to save ourselves by finding more worlds to ravage and more resources to plunder. By conquering space the way we've conquered Earth, we'll just be exporting the whole disastrous system out to our wider cosmic neighborhood. In fact, if we continue on the outer spatial path we're currently on, we might get to the point where we pile so much crap into orbit around Earth that we lock ourselves inside a halo of trash, unable to launch anything at all. Trapped by the mess we've made inside of the mess we've made. Insight number 5. There are other ways to live. One early review of Astrotopia said that the arguments were perfectly sound, but annoying and unrealistic. It's hopeless, said the reviewer, to try to stop these billionaires from building their dream worlds. I mean, what are we going to do? Abolish capitalism? I face the same problem in class when I ask my students to consider the alternative Jeff Bezos rejects. We're using too much energy, he says. We can't go on like this. So either we stop using so much energy, or we leave the planet in favor of solar-paneled space islands. To Bezos, the choice is clear. Life without infinite energy is boring and therefore not really an option. To my students, the choice is also clear, although they feel terrible about it. How could we possibly get people to use less water, buy less stuff, give up their cars? Clearly, that's impossible. So we're going to have to leave the planet. At which point I ask them, how did it become more thinkable to live without water and air than it would be to live without smartphones? It seems the old saying is right. It is easier to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of capitalism. But there are some people among us, lots of them even, who can imagine the end of capitalism. For them, living less comfortably on Earth is easier to imagine than living without Earth. So it's here that we might turn down the volume on the techno-profits and listen to other voices instead. Throughout the planet, there are communities that have managed to live with and through and as their land without destroying it. Throughout the planet, there are authors and artists who've brought whole worlds into being on principles of kindness, equality, and justice. And throughout the planet, there are religious sages who teach us that the Earth is sacred, or that the Earth is divine, or that the Earth is a gift of God or the gods, and as such is not here to support our untrammeled profiteering. Such sages include Pope Francis himself, who in a gesture of what I like to think of as atonement on behalf of his early modern predecessors who gave the whole world to Europe, insists that the Earth belongs to the poor, that all living creatures are our siblings, and that the kingdom of God cannot be built on extraction, exploitation, and greed. So that's what I'd say to the space messiahs. More importantly, it's what I'd say to the humans among us who feel carried off by their utopian promises. Other ways of living are right here before our eyes, and if we take them seriously on Earth, they might even teach us how to explore outer space without ransacking it, how to live on new land without exploiting it, and how to value knowledge, relationships, and life itself over profit. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Thank you, Mary Jane. That was Mary Jane Rubenstein with 5 big ideas from Astrotopia, the dangerous religion of the corporate space race. For some related ideas, check out our book bite for Survival of the Richest, Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires by Douglas Rushkoff. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.